I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Today, a special program devoted to religion. In the second hour, Peter Manso, an historian based in Maryland, takes on the stubborn claim that the United States is fundamentally Christian. In fact, he says the country has a rich history of religious diversity, some of it obvious, some of it hidden. Up front, open phone lines for John Renard, a scholar of Islam and author of a new handy book about the beliefs of the more than 500 million Muslims on the planet. At a time when many Americans fear rather than understand Islam, we take a look at the faith's traditions, as well as where it overlaps with Christianity and Judaism. Our two-hour special on religion begins with John Renard and the Handy Islam Answer Book, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Today on the show, we devote both hours to religion, starting in this hour with Islam scholar John Renard and his Handy Islam Answer Book, which presents an opportunity for Midday listeners to get their questions answered about the world's second largest religion, now about 1.6 billion people. I earlier stated more than half a billion. It's actually 1.6 billion worldwide. In the second hour of the show, we meet Peter Manso, a historian and journalist based here in Maryland, whose book on religion in the founding and early days of the United States and Maryland offers a unique look at a story often presented as a story of Christianity's arrival and expansion in the New World. In fact, Peter Manso points out, the country has a rich history of religious diversity, some of it obvious, some of it hidden, not so obvious. Peter Manso will be with us between 1 and 2 p.m. to discuss his new book, One Nation Under Gods, plural, an exploration of the role of religious minorities in shaping Maryland and American history. But we start today's special with a look at Islam. In this hour of Midday, Islamic scholar John Renard joins us to discuss common American misconceptions about that faith and broaden our perspectives on Muslim traditions, principles, and history. The growing presence of Islam in this country frightens many Americans, John Renard writes. They have come to associate the very mention of Islam with strangeness and mystery and, alas, violence. From the attacks of 9/11 to the decapitation of American journalist James Foley last summer to the massacre of a dozen people in the offices of the French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo in January, international media has had many opportunities to highlight the aforementioned violence that is associated with self-proclaimed Islamic groups. President Obama, among others, has weighed in about extremists such as ISIS or ISIL, who label themselves as Muslims. Last year, the president said, quote, ISIL is not Islam. No religion condones the killings of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim. Still, others believe that the actions of the Islamic extremist groups are condoned by the majority of Muslims. Comedian-turned-political commentator Bill Maher, who was in Baltimore just over the weekend performing at the Lyric, frequently takes the opportunity on his program Real Time to candidly condemn Islam.
And finally, new rule, now that it's been a month since I gave the commencement address at Berkeley, someone has to check in with the people who tried to have my speech canceled and make sure they made it through okay. Also, since they were protesting me for once saying that Islam is, quote, the only religion that acts like the mafia and will kill you if you say the wrong thing or draw the wrong picture, and then two jihadists gunned down 12 people in Paris for saying the wrong thing and drawing the wrong picture, you have to tell me, where do I go to protest you?
While Bill Maher is suspicious of and ridicules all forms of organized religion, he takes particular exception to Islam, and he criticizes liberals for being too timid when it comes to condemning Muslims for fear of sounding racist. Many Americans have limited knowledge of Islam, considered the fastest-growing religion in the world, as I mentioned, 1.6 billion now, more than 1.5 billion people practice Islam, 1.6 billion, several million of whom are Americans. So our guest this hour, John Renard, defines Islam as a tradition that sees itself as a culmination, completion and correction of Judaism and Christianity. We'll get to ask him more about that during this hour of the show, and I hope you will join me in asking questions you've always wanted to pose to an expert about Islam. Our phone number is 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And you can send a question by email to midday@wypr.org. A Roman Catholic, John Renard's interest in Islam began in the 1960s. In 1978, he earned a doctorate in Islamic studies from Harvard. He's written close to a dozen books about Islam, including this most recent one, The Handy Islam Answer Book, published by Visible Ink Press. Not Invisible, right? Visible Ink. Yes, Visible Ink Press. John, thank you for joining us on the Midday Show today.
Morning, Dan. Thank you for inviting me.
In your book, you define Islam as, I was just saying part of it here, I want to give a little bit more, as Abrahamic monotheistic faith tradition that sees itself as a culmination, completion, and correction of Judaism and Christianity. Certainly, many can draw comparisons to Muhammad and Christ, but what are the main differences between those two, the Prophet Muhammad and Jesus Christ? What is the specific completion or correction that you're referring to there? Let's start with that.
Islamic tradition holds that there is one true message that God began to deliver to the human race with Adam, and through a succession of dozens and possibly even countless numbers of prophets, delivered this message. Unfortunately, the tradition says, various people to whom these messages were delivered, including Jews through whom they got the message via the prophet Moses, according to the Islamic view, and Christians who got the message via Jesus, whom they consider a prophet, didn't like the message and tampered with it and tried to think of other ways of watering that message down, and that as a result, God's plan included a correction of that message by means of the message that he delivered through Muhammad, considered the last of the prophets, in a text, or what became a text called the Quran, the recitation. So it started off as a recitation, that is, oral delivery of what Muslims believe were revealed messages directly to the prophet, who then preached them, in essence, to the people. So in a way, the Muslim view of Islam's supersession, that is, taking the place of earlier traditions, is not unlike the Christian view of Christianity's supersession over Judaism. The big difference is, one big difference is that the Islamic tradition considers it the final message correcting not just mistakes or misunderstandings of Christians and Jews, but of all the religious traditions of the world who have been recipients of some sort of a primal message of this one revealing God.
Along those lines, let me ask you about people of the book or peoples of the book.
Yes.
What is that then, John?
That's a Muslim concept that allows for a larger category which specifies certain traditions. Judaism is one, Christianity is one. According to there are different lists, but another one of them is the Zoroastrian tradition, a Persian tradition that goes back to the 6th century BC, and a prophet, a man who is considered a prophet by Zoroastrians, named Zarathustra or Zoroaster. So there are varying different lists of what communities belong under this umbrella of the peoples of the book. Some of them I've even heard, and not too fairly straightforwardly, includes, for example, even Hinduism. Now, that's very unusual, but it's a category of religious communities who received an authoritative and valid message from God, but in some instances, they've lost it altogether. But the point of the category is that these are communities that deserve respect from the Muslim community.
So the idea there is that, well, there's an acknowledgement that God has given revelations through prophets to all these people, all these communities then.
Right. There's God has a primordial message that, as I say, started with Adam, goes through a succession of prophets. And the way it's been received has been various. And many Muslims think that that, in some ways, applies to even the Muslim community, that there are variations within the Muslim communities that, that some find offensive or unacceptable. And that's the kind of thing you're finding, you're seeing played out now, that antipathy to members who call them, people who call themselves Muslims, such as Shiites especially, or in some cases even Sunnis who aren't towing the line the way groups like ISIS would like them to, and they've simply declared them not worthy of the name Muslim.
Hmm. And one last question about that. Is it peoples of the book or people of the book?
I've heard it both ways.
Both ways. Okay. So does it suggest that under Islam, all of this is leading somewhere, that Muslims have a belief that we're all going to worship the same God someday?
That's a view that many Muslims have. And in fact, that's a view that is shared on a different level by many Christians. They believe, and many Christians still believe, that the conversion of the world to Christianity would be a good thing. And a lot of Muslims feel the same way. So they think of belief in the one true God, pure monotheism, that is, it's uncontaminated by the complexities of the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, which Muslims believe is polytheism, that's tritheism. There are three different personalities. But that's, of course, Christians say that's a serious misunderstanding that goes back a long way. But the view that Islam represents the one true monotheism, pure, simple belief in a total, transcendent, unified being who is beyond all beings, that's the culmination of religious belief.
We're speaking with John Renard about his new book, The Handy Islam Answer Book. John is a professor at St. Louis University in the Department of Theological Studies there. So I want to ask you this question. Your book is set up as a Q&A, questions and answers. And I've asked our listeners to participate in this hour with you today, John, to get their questions answered.
Yes.
So what are the common questions that you're asked when someone finds out that you're the Islam Answer Man?
Well,
two or three most common questions you get, especially from Americans.
Well, one of them is, why are they so violent? Why do they mistreat women? They're all questions about extreme behavior that in no way represents all 1.6 billion people. So the first thing that I find myself trying to do is to explain to people, 1.6 billion people in dozens of cultures speaking scores of different languages, they are not just a huge monolithic reality. So when you talk about Muslims, you're talking about a reality as diverse as what you refer to when you speak of Christianity or even Hinduism or Buddhism, because there are multiple families within those large super traditions. Now, a lot of Muslims are offended by that. A lot of Muslims will simply say, no, there's only one kind of Muslim, and that's the true Muslim, and anybody who doesn't measure up is simply outside the pale. Well, I know some Christians who believe that as well. I mean, I know some Christians who think that because I'm a Catholic, I'm outside the pale of Christianity. So it's one of these things I try to point out that, first of all, Muslims are human beings like us, and there is no way that you can label all of Islam or all of Muslims, let alone the entire history of this tradition, as malevolent or somehow sinister, let alone evil. I mean, there are people who do evil things and label themselves Muslims. That's a fact. And things that are going on in the Middle East now are, to be perfectly blunt about it, barbaric, savage, sadistic, sociopathic criminals. And it doesn't matter really what they say by way of trying to justify their claims and through some religious argument. they're behaving like just that kind of people that I just described. And it's unacceptable to the human race. Now, there is an interesting phenomenon that a lot of people I talk to think, well, you know, there are hundreds of millions of Muslims who are out to get us. Well, that's just simply nonsense. There may be hundreds of millions out of that 1.6 billion who really do think that it would be in the best interest of the human race if Islam was the one true religion. But they're not alone among people who think that about their faith traditions. So that's the biggest, the most important thing. I try to start the discussion by saying these are human beings. A lot of them are suffering terribly at the hands of these very people who claim to be the true Muslims. And it's essential that we begin to understand ourselves in human terms before we go condemning this huge 22% of the human race as evil.
So you get that question, John, and thank you for your answer. And then the follow-up question would be, but there's jihad, right? There's a holy war against the West because we wear skimpy clothing. Women in this country wear bikinis and men wear blue jeans and we watch too much television, right? Isn't there a jihad against us?
There is such a thing as jihad, but there again, it's important to get some perspective. Nothing is so simple as they hate the way we dress or they hate the food we eat. Nothing of that sort really comes anywhere near to explaining the reality. There is at the bottom of all what is happening in the Middle East in the so-called Arab Spring and in ISIS and in South Asia in the activities of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and in Nigeria, Boko Haram, there is a strong element of political and economic and social control involved in these things. Now, some of these people would like to take over the world. There is such a thing as transnational jihad. And what you see in the case of Al-Qaeda and its more recent metamorphosis into ISIL or ISIS, those guys are transnational. In other words, they really want to export this. But the majority of the jihadi groups tend to be more regional or local, or I guess you could say national. Some of them have this notion that if they just connect with others of these regional or local groups, they can make the bridges and so forth. But it's important to understand that when people say that there are hundreds of millions of Muslims out there to get us, lying in wait, and there's sleeper cells and all that sort of thing, that's simply not – just to get some historical perspective about this, there are 1.6 billion Muslims. If you say that 0.1% of those are actively involved in jihad, say, in the Middle East, that would be 160,000 people. 160,000 active men under arms or women under arms in the Middle East. That actually far exceeds the number that we know are actively involved in the Middle East currently. Now, if you take I said 100, that's a hundredth of a percent. A tenth of a percent would be 1.6 million. And that also is far larger than the known number of jihadis, active jihadis, in the entire world. So, you know, we've got to get some perspective on this thing. It's not this horrifying juggernaut that it's made out to be frequently.
John, we'll take a break here. John Renard, our guest, his book, The Handy Islam Answer Book. Feel free to give us a call during this hour of midday. I have a couple of questions already from our listeners, 410-662-8780. And remember, you can address a question about Islam for John Renard by email, that address midday@wypr.org, or just tweet a question to MiddayWYPR or Dan Rodericks. And welcome back to the first of 2 hours on religion today on the Midday Show. In this hour, all about Islam. Any question you'd like to ask our guest, John Renard, of St. Louis University, Islamic scholar and author now of the Handy Islam Answer Book. What's another common question that you get from Americans once you get past that discussion about Islam and violence?
One of the most common ones is, why do Muslims mistreat their women the way they do? And here again, this has to be seen in a much broader perspective. First of all, there is this curious thing about interpreting what the Quran says about how women should dress. The Quran does not specifically require any specific form of dress, but merely that they should cover women should cover their enticements, their allurements, their sexuality, I guess you could say. It doesn't say that has to be a veil or it has to be a scarf or let alone a floor to tucked up of the head to the soles of the foot kind of dress. So this is a really good instance to talk about the importance and the relationship between religion and culture. And frequently, my experience of doing this for over 40 years is that when religion and culture collide, culture almost invariably wins. Now, what that means is that if you look around across the globe and you observe that there are so many different forms of Islamically acceptable, at least in the local culture, garb for women, you understand that this is another one of those things that is not monolithic. But I think what most Americans get in their consciousness and their image of Islam is some kind of total covering with this kind of bizarre little slot for an eye, for eyes to peer out. But the idea is fundamentally that in different cultures, different interpretations of that very, very vague suggestion in the Quran result in a variety of different women's covered fashions, everything from scarves and no covering over the face to scarves or head veils with a veil over the lower face to even things that look like one-piece sheaths that go from head to foot, and there's just a little grill where the eyes can be. So it's a tremendous amount of variety there. Now, the second thing I want to point out is that this, you know, mistreatment of women is a global problem. Islam is in no way uniquely responsible or inherently misogynist any more than the rest of the world. I mean, just look at, for example, I don't mean to pick on India, but I mean, probably many of your listeners have been hearing stories lately about the tremendous amount of spousal abuse and abuse of women in India. And there have been some very widely publicized rape cases and so forth. Now, India is predominantly, and I mean almost entirely, Hindu. About 1.2 billion people in India and between 800 and 900 million people are Hindu. Minority populations of Muslims, a big one, actually 120 million, and Christianity. So you can't blame Hinduism, and people don't generally blame Hinduism for this massive problem. And they don't blame Catholicism for the massive problems of abuse of women in Latin America. But for some reason or other, when examples of abuse of women or what Westerners take to be abuse of women come up with respect to Islam, it's, oh, there they go again. Mm-hmm. It's uniquely Islamic. It is not.
For John Renard, a question from Tom in Parkville, a question about an experience that he had. Tom, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thanks, Dan. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, John. Love your topic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My wife and I had an interesting experience in Jerusalem 3 weeks ago. We were at the Dome of the Rock as Christian tourists, and threw my arm over my wife's shoulder for a picture. And even as I did it, I thought, oh, this is probably wrong. And sure enough, two guys came charging at us saying, no touch, no touch. And, you know, made us delete the picture, which I was happy to do. And one of them spoke very politely to us about the need to do that, because if it got posted on Facebook, it would cause such problems for them. And then he very nicely shot three wonderful pictures of us with the Dome of the Rock behind us, but not touching.
That's a very interesting experience, and I think it's not unusual. There has been, in the last 20 or 30 years, a very decided turn to the right, to the more conservative, in many cultures in which Islam is a dominant presence. There's no doubt about it. When I first went, for example, to Cairo, almost 40 years ago, you could see films in the movie houses that poked fun at religion, and these characters with their snidely whiplash mustaches, and they would say really, you know, things about religion, poking fun and so forth, that you would never hear now. And so that's a good example. I think social norms have been changing the last 30 or 40 years, and so what you experienced, I think, is a good example of that. And I'm glad to hear that they were simply explaining to you that some things are not publicly acceptable. This is not what people want to see in the context of this very sacred shrine. And nothing personal. It's just that there are things that are no longer as acceptable as they might have been 40 years ago.
John Renard, our guest from the Department of Theological Studies at St. Louis University, author and most recently the author of The Handy Islam Answer Book, published by Visible Ink Press. 410-662-8780 is the number if you have a question for John Renard while he's with us in this first hour of our two-part show on religion today. Joe in Baltimore with a comment, a question for our guest. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hi. I have a question for, excuse me, for John. I think you have two ways of looking at it. You have two major, theoreticians. I'm more familiar with the politics, more a political scientist than I am a religious-ist. But you have, on the one hand, you have somebody like, what's that guy's name? John Esposito, I think his
Esposito,
name is.
Esposito, yes.
Yeah.
And he's pretty much a he's kind of pro-Islam and probably your philosophy of looking at it pretty logically and pretty much looking at the good points of it as it comes out. And then you have, let's say, Bernard Lewis, who is also a great scholar, but he's much more negative in his analysis of Islam, I guess. For whatever reason, maybe he's a Britisher and he's maybe wants reintroduction of the British Raj. I don't know for his
What's your question, though, Joe?
Okay, my question is: I tend to not to think that because I look at Jerry Falwell, and as much as I despised him, he's not trying to kill me. Whereas you still see these elements of Islam, and somebody did blow us up on September 11th. And they weren't Christian scientists. They came from the Muslim world, and they're psychotic and psychopathic. And I think there's something indigenous to that religion that makes them kind of retarded and still stuck in medieval history.
Okay, let's hear from John on that.
Thanks, John. This really is a thorny question, and it's very difficult sometimes to separate out issues of violence and expressed motivation for violence. And there is no doubt that this is a problem. I mean, there are some people who regard Islam as a justification for certain kinds of violence. But there are people in other traditions, and I know that this is not currently in the news, but what I like to pose to people is the question of, for example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa, over a period of 15 years of what is euphemistically referred to as a civil war, 5 million people were slaughtered at the hands of people who were not Muslims. In fact, the population of that country is 3 to 4% Muslim. What does one say about that? 5 million people, all for the price of a diamond or gold. So my question is not why do people who call themselves, who say that they are motivated by some religion, do what they do. My question is, how can people get away with a massive slaughter like that and never have it make the news in the Western press? That's my question. I'm not trying to get out from under the question of religious motivation. My question is, how does this fit into the broader story of human motivation and rationalization for massive violence?
We also don't tend to look at actions by Christians in terms of their religion. Irish Republican Army, the days of the IRA, the Ku Klux Klan, for instance, or even most recently, a young accused killer in Charleston, South Carolina, who went into a church and killed 9 African-American churchgoers. We don't immediately rush to what religion was that person.
It's true, and I think this is a serious problem of equity in the way we look at world affairs. It's also important. I know generally Americans are brought up thinking that Muslims are those odd people who have no capacity for separating religious and civil spheres. Well, that's simply not true. This again, is much more complicated. There have been all kinds of institutional developments in the 1,400-year history of Islam and the various different religio-political entities, sometimes they're called dynasties, in which there are separate institutional structures to deal with religious and civil spheres, different systems of law. Sharia is not the only one. There are other kinds of law in these large historical political entities. So a great deal of what is expressed as religiously motivated is, in fact, politically motivated. There's a political dimension in all this stuff. As you just mentioned, Dan, the thing that happened for many generations, several generations in Northern Ireland, what they call the Troubles, is often labeled Protestant Catholic. But it's been hundreds of years since that was actually a religious conflict. It's about money, it's about power, it's about influence and social status. They hate each other because they now represent communities that are, in all those different ways, socially, politically, economically, culturally, they are now distinct and they represent one having power over the other. That's what's behind a lot of what we perceive as the so-called religious claim to want to take over, to take down the West. There are political dimensions of this that are too little described in public discourse.
John, one more question before our next break. This one by email on the subject of gender and in Islam. You were talking about women before. This one from Marie. There are very conservative Orthodox Christian and Jewish religions that greatly restrict women and very progressive denominations that have women as equals. Does Islam also have this range of inclusiveness for women?
Thanks for that, Marie. There is very definitely a spectrum in this respect, just as there is in practically every other question that comes up about Islam in the world today. When in doubt, think diversity. There are women in – well, let me give you a good example of Americans tend to think of Iran as, well, just hopeless. I mean, it's just a barbaric place. They want to be – they want to rule the world with an Ayatollah who's medieval in his manner and thought patterns. But in Iran, there are major surprises with respect to gender, even though the public face of Iranian women invariably shows them in a wrap called a chador, sometimes which they use to cover their face and sometimes not. But in Iran, the majority of university students are women, and there are women who are chairs of major departments in universities in such a way that you would not find that in the United States. For example, there is a woman who is a chair of the physics department in the University of Tehran, the country's biggest department. I was really quite shocked when I heard that. It suggests that our notions of gender roles and gender separation with respect to Islam are simply not adequate to explain the realities.
John, thank you. We're going to take a break here and come back and talk some more, take some more questions for John Renard, author of The Handy Islam Answer Book. You can reach us at 410-662-8780. Dan Rodrigues here. A short break. We'll be right back. John Renard, our guest from St. Louis University, The Handy Islam Answer Book. John, a bit of a lightning round here for the next few minutes. I'm going to ask you, you four or five quick questions and try to be brief with your answers, and then we'll take some more calls. Let's see.
Okay.
I don't know if you can be brief with some of these. These are tricky. All right, here's one. Theories of evolution. How do theories of evolution fit within Islam, if at all?
There are different views about that, and I think you'll find, and again, a range that is more or less consonant with the range that you would find in among Christians with respect to that. They go from there is a particular time and place that we can date to the exact minute when God created the world, and that God has been involved in every step of the way. So evolution would, I suppose most Muslims would understand evolution as something that's always divinely guided, if there is such a thing as evolution.
And a follow-up question, sort of connected, sort of, I guess. Could you talk about predestination in Islam?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. That's another one of those biggies. Most Muslims believe, I would say, well, let me just say the standard traditional view is that God is in control of all things. That's what the expression Allahu Akbar means. It means God is supreme. God is the greatest. That means that everything that happens, good or evil, is under the control of God. And the alternative would be to say that somebody else is in control of the bad stuff, and that would be the devil. And that's, in the Islamic tradition, the devil is nasty, but he is nothing compared to God. So the notion that people's choices are all controlled by God is something that most Muslims that I know, at least, they would nuance it a little bit. They'd say, look, you know, God knows what I'm going to do, but that doesn't mean that I can just do whatever I want, because he would stop me from doing what I'm not supposed to do. So people would say, you know, I'm responsible for my actions, and whatever I do, it's because God had that in his plan.
Interesting. All right, here are a couple of questions from Frank in Aberdeen, Maryland. First of all, what is the difference between Sunni and Shiite?
Okay, Frank, thanks for that. This is a big, broad question, but I'll try and be brief. The division between the what is now about 15% of the global Muslim community and the majority called the Sunnis, pardon me, began in around the year 632 when Muhammad died. There was an argument, there was a disagreement as to what would be the criteria for the person who would succeed Muhammad as caliph. That's the word successor, caliph. What became the dominant position, majority position, or Sunni, said Muhammad didn't want anybody to be – he didn't appoint anybody. He wanted people to be chosen from a council of elders. The Shiite position – the word Shia means partisans, because they were a faction of supporting the successorship of Ali – claimed that Muhammad had actually appointed or designated a successor, and that person was a member of his family. So from then on, the Shiite view was that legitimate succession to the prophet had to be designated by a predecessor and had to be a member of the family of the prophet. So Shiites consider themselves members of the family of the prophet, and that their leaders all through the ages have been, or at least up until the 8th century, were designated by a predecessor. And that's where it all diverged.
Follow-up question. Well, second question from Frank on heaven and hell. Where are Muslims on their beliefs about heaven and hell?
Heaven and hell represent for most Muslims, as I think for most Christians, places. Some people are a little more they were willing to think that these are states of being rather than places. But since Muslims believe in the very almost identical last things, that is death, judgment, reward, or punishment. There's a few little wrinkles in the shape of the cosmos post after this life, but most Muslims will think that there is a heaven and it's eternal. Many historically think that hell is also possibly eternal punishment, but not necessarily, because it can play the dual role of what Christians think are played by purgatory. That's a temporary purification space, and then hell, which is always permanent. Technically, hell is not forever. It's possible for one to be forgiven and purified in that state.
Bob writes in to say, I worked and lived in Guyana, which has a sizable Muslim population. I even attended a friend's Muslim Christian wedding. I doubt that would happen in, say, the Middle East. None of the women there wore total coverings. In fact, I saw very few women who even covered their heads. None of my Muslim friends did. A question about the 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Where do they live? Where do most of them live? I think Americans have this belief, perhaps the misconception, that most of them live in the Arab world.
About one fifth of the total Muslim population are Arabs. So that's the first thing. Now, somewhat more than that still speak Arabic, but there are major ethnic groups in North Africa, for example, such as the Berbers, who are different. But the largest Muslim populations in the world are in South Asia. That is, the so-called Indian subcontinent, which includes Pakistan, which is all Muslim, Bangladesh, almost all Muslim, and India, which has a large Muslim population, 120, maybe 140 million. So there's nearly half a billion Muslims live in South Asia. Throw in another 200 million in Indonesia, and you've got almost half the world Muslim population, which is way east of the Middle East. And so that's something that I think is frequently very different than the usual perception of where Muslims live.
Hmm. Is it incorrect to say Muslims worship Muhammad? They worship Allah, or they worship Muhammad, or both?
No, they do not worship Muhammad. Muhammad is a human being, a very lofty human being. If you want to say that he was as close to perfect as a human being could be, you could say that. But he was a human being, so they do not worship Muhammad at all, which is why Muslims don't like the term Mohammedanism. Almost nobody ever uses it, but God is the supreme object of worship. Muhammad is an object of reverence, of admiration, and as a source of imitation, but not of worship.
John Renard, here's another question by email. This one from Samuel at the University of Maryland, writing to us to ask, in your opinion, John, what needs to be done to liberalize / de-radicalize Islamist and Islamist fundamentalist groups?
I don't know, to be quite blunt about it. I don't know that that can happen from the outside. I think this is something that has to happen from within the Muslim communities in which these groups are most active and where almost all of their victims are Muslims. And I think it has to be it's going to be a generational thing. I mean, these groups didn't appear overnight. And as a result, the solution to the problem is going to take lots of time. And unfortunately, along the way, there will be probably some failed states. There will be some massive increases in poverty in various places. But it will come back as people begin to reestablish themselves as communities, which not only value diversity but have the political will and the economic clout to support that.
Hmm. A caller called earlier and left us a note, wanted to ask a question without being on the air, wanted to know from you why we don't see Muslims protesting terrorist attacks when they or their family members or their villages or cities are victimized by terrorist attacks. And then on Twitter, Mary tweets, have any Middle Eastern Muslim leaders denounced the Islamic State or terrorism? Do they encourage tolerance of other cultures and beliefs? So those are all kind of mixed together there a bit. But first, about you know, maybe we don't see this here in the Western world on television or read about it in the paper, about protests against the violence there.
It's true. We do not. We don't see this. And the reason, it would be a long story, but the reason is there is an accepted narrative about Islam and Muslims in the Western world, especially in the United States. And it does not include willingness to acknowledge that people have been shouting about terrorism since the afternoon of 9/11. And people have been putting out, major scholars from the Middle East, even from the most conservative institutions in Saudi Arabia and in Cairo, people have been making it very clear that these folks are not Muslims. There have been dramatic collections of sort of joint statements by scholars over the last 5-10 years, universal collections of these scholars from all the great Muslim institutions of higher learning, making it perfectly clear they denounce these things, but it doesn't make the U.S. press because, as I say, it doesn't fit the acceptable narrative. There's a need to keep somehow, I think, Islam as the source of evil, because you got to have somebody you can pin things on. And I really believe that that's the case.
Janet in Pikesville, going back to the subject of Jesus and Islam, thanks for calling. Janet, go right ahead with your question for John Renard.
Yes, I believe Jesus is mentioned around 93 times in the Quran. And could you explain how Jesus is portrayed in the Quran?
Sure, Janet. Thank you for that question. This is one of those really excellent points at which Christians and Jews can get together. But there is this theological hang-up, and that is that Christians think Jesus is God. Muslims simply do not accept that. He is a human being. He is a prophet. He's on the level of somebody like Muhammad. He's one of the greatest prophets. He's considered not just a prophet, but a messenger, that is, one through whom a certain scripture was revealed. And his story in the Quran is very interesting, because there is a chapter in the Quran, chapter 19. It's named after Mary. And Mary actually has a little bit larger role in the Quran than she does in the New Testament. And the story is a little more elaborate. Now, the sources of these stories are what Christians call apocryphal. But in the Islamic tradition, stories that occur in the Quran and in the Bible, let's put it this way, stories about famous people like Jesus and Abraham and Moses are the shared property of the people of the Middle East going back a very long time. So there is a wonderful reverence for Jesus in the Muslim tradition and for his mother.
And Mary.
Yes.
Sounds like Mary, too. You know, you'll be shocking some people with this by pointing this out, John Renard.
Well, on the one hand, I hope so. On the other hand, I'm sorry that that's the case, but because it's a wonderful connection. The Islamic literature about the prophets and their families, including Mary, who they consider a mother of a prophet, is really quite rich. And there's a lot of common ground there for Muslims and Christians to talk about. And it reminds me of what I think is, in essence, the most difficult and most important thing. A lot of people, I'd say the vast majority of people, who think the most negative thoughts about Islam have never actually met a Muslim and had a conversation.
John, I thank you for this conversation. John, I wish we could continue, but get John Renard's book if you have more questions about Islam. It's called The Handy Islam Answer Book. John Renard, our guest in this first hour of the show, teaches courses in Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism at St. Louis University. John, thank you. I really appreciated this, getting some time with you on this, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Dan. It's a very enjoyable hour.
Yep, same. I agree. Same here. We have another hour coming up on religion, so please stay tuned for that. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us on Mondays by Rosina Gourmet, located in Canton, downtown Baltimore and Harbor East. Catering available at rosinagourmet.com. Please stay tuned for the news.